not proud, but that was me. And when I face it, I take back a little dignity. Not looking for excuses, I just want to be free from the power weakness head on. Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Bubble Hour, where real people tell real stories of addiction and recovery. I'm Jean McCarthy, recovery author, blogger, and podcast host. I've been chronicling my adventures in life after alcohol since my first day of sobriety over 9 years ago in my blog Unpickled and in books like The Unpickled Holiday Survival Guide, which I encourage you to get a copy of since the holidays are right around the corner and the best way to protect your recovery is to plan ahead. Also, my poetry collection, The Ember Ever There, poems about grief, growth, recovery, and rediscovery. So I tell my stories there, and I hold space for your stories here. And today, I'm holding space for Mandy Manners and Kate Bailey. They are hosts of the Love Sober podcast, and they have a new book out called Love Yourself Sober, a self-care guide for alcohol-free living for busy mothers. Now, whether you're a mother or a caregiver of another sort, you're going to find a lot of good information in this book, and I think you're going to really enjoy my chat with Kate Bailey and Mandy Manners. Mandy and Kate of Love Sober, welcome to the Bubble Hour.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Hi.
I'm so pleased you're here. Congratulations on your beautiful book. Really exciting stuff. It is a wonderful resource, and I'm so pleased for you, and I'm pleased for our recovery community to have this excellent material. So before we talk about the book, I want our listeners to just get to know you and connect your voices with your story. So Mandy, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, yeah. So I am British, but I live in France. I've lived in France for nearly, just over 14 years. So I grew up kind of, I suppose, my drinking, if we're talking about my drinking story, I grew up in the British kind of 90s Britpop binge drinking kind of culture, very much like, you know, we drank with the men and kind of drank to excess at the weekends and very much sort of into music. I started drinking when I was 14, which was actually really normal in kind of where I grew up in the UK at that time. I just kind of drank a lot at the weekends up until I moved to France, and really was kind of motherhood that sort of changed my relationship with alcohol. I actually had quite a traumatic experience when I was 18, and I'd never really dealt with that. And I think when I had my daughter, the PTSD that had never been treated kind of, this is all what I've kind of picked together now, but sort of came to the forefront, and I was living in a lot of fear. I was hypervigilant, and so alcohol kind of became a coping strategy to kind of manage that I had this huge anxiety that I was going to do something wrong with her, or that she was going to be unhappy, or something bad was going to happen to her. And then I had my son 19 months later, and I was living in another country, and French culture is very sort of centered around fine wine, you know, food and wine is very romantic, very part of the culture in a different way to how I grew up in the UK. And I think I was trying to model French behavior, you know, having a glass of wine with dinner every night, but with my kind of British habitual drinking, coupled with my mental health problems, kind of spiraled out of control, really. And so I got very depressed, and I was working pretty much full time as a university professor. So everything kind of looked okay. I was succeeding, but I was deeply, deeply unhappy and deeply lonely. And so in 2013, in December, well, actually in the sort of August, September, I tried to stop drinking and smoking and everything, and I had a really big kind of panic attack. And at that point, my husband sort of took me to the doctor, and I sort of, he had to explain everything because my French wasn't that good, and sort of explained what was going on in my head. And at that point, I was very low. I didn't feel like I was good at anything. I wasn't a good mum, wasn't a good teacher, wasn't a good wife. I wasn't really sleeping, huge insomnia, and drinking, you know, probably a bottle of wine a night. And so that sort of started me on a journey of therapy. I got put on antidepressants, started going on to sort of CBT. And by December of that year, I was like, there's something going on here. You know, I'm trying to stop. I'm trying to making promises to myself about it, trying to cut down, and I'm not able to. And so in December, I sort of Googled in the middle of the night, as a lot of us did, am I an alcoholic? Do I have a problem with alcohol? And I found Soberistas, which is a wonderful forum. And it was something that I could access from where I was. It was English speaking, and I started blogging. That kind of was off and on until about 6 months, I'd say. And then I quit drinking for a year. And everything got better, and I felt fantastic, and my mental health improved, and I weaned, you know, with my doctor, I weaned myself off medication. And then we moved, and I thought, well, I'll drink just now and again because it's social and I don't have any friends and I can't be a non-drinker. And I really hadn't worked out who I was without alcohol. I kind of been relying on willpower, I think. So I started drinking every now and again, and you know, so it progressed to more and more, and just my mental health really, really deteriorated quite significantly and quite quickly, until 2017, when I just went, you know what, I'm done this time. and so I've been sober ever since, and it was very different the second time round. It wasn't out of a place of desperation. It was very much more, I could keep trying to keep this in my life, but it's making me really unhappy and I don't want that anymore. And because I'd been in therapy, I'd been doing work on PTSD, and I'd found that sort of sense of self-worth really enough for me to go, you know what, I don't want you and I don't need you. And so I'm happily sober, and it was the best decision I ever made, really. So that's a short version.
Well, I love it. I love that it has such a piece in your mental health.
Yeah.
Because I think so many of us try to self-medicate with alcohol, and it not only doesn't help, it makes it worse, and it makes it impossible for us to deal with the underlying issues.
Yeah.
And
yeah, because really I used to say to my husband, because I would, you know, the period from the first year that I did, and then when I finally stopped, you know, I'd drink for about 2 to 3 months, and it would progressively get a bit more, and my sleep would, you know, get worse, and my mental health would get worse. And I'd sort of say to my husband, you know, wasn't I happier when I didn't drink at all? And he'd say yes, and I'd go, oh, la 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 la, okay, and and carry on up until, and it was that real kind of leveling up of, you know, of healing the shame. I had so much shame, you know, obviously, you know, having kind of a sexual trauma at a young age. I was, you know, very disconnected from myself and from my own self-worth and who I was as a person. And I thought I was fundamentally bad and I'd caused things to happen to me, you know. So it's that healing of the whole person. But sobriety was a fundamental part of that. And every time I stopped, you know, concentrating on my sobriety and went back to drinking, I'd just lose that again. And I'd be back to forgetting about myself and not looking after myself. And yeah, so I'm very, very grateful.
Kate, tell us about yourself.
Hi. Oh, it's like, you know, I you know, when I listen to Mandy again, and we talk a lot and we've heard our stories a lot, but I just, sometimes it kind of gets me and I feel quite emotional, you know, about the journey and about the struggle. And but about me. Okay, so there are some elements that are similar to Mandy, I suppose. I'm a little bit older, so my drinking really started in my teenage years, when I was about 16, 15, 16. And it was very much you know, it was the 80s, so snake bite, pints of snake bite and black. We were matching the lads sort of drinking, and it never occurred to me not to drink. It never occurred to me that it wouldn't be part of my teenage life and then my adult life, you know, like so many of us. It was part of the fabric of British culture and the rite of passage. And then I suppose in my 20s I kind of swapped it out, and it was because I was kind of the Sex and the City generation. So I was a journalist. I was at Dumb Uni. I was living in London. And really, now I look back again, you know, because you do piece things together in hindsight, don't you? I was kind of doing what everyone else did, really. And we were binge drinking. We were going out after work. We were drinking cocktails. It was, you know, going home. I was in a house share in London. So it looked like Friends, you know, the Friends generation that were sponsored. Our lives were sponsored by Blossom Hill or something. And, you know, it all just looked fine. Underneath that, I always say it was a bit like a duck, like everything looked fine on the surface with me. I worked so hard to make everything look all right and to prove to myself that I was kind of coping. And underneath, I was paddling really, really, really hard. And I was most definitely self-medicating with alcohol since literally the first time I drank it, like literally the first time. I'd suffered a lot of anxiety as a kid. And I do remember the first time I drank was my brother's engagement party, and it was a house party. And I just remember being in the loo, looking at this kind of weird patterned wallpaper. And I was just like, oh, I'm happy. Like, I heard my voice say, I'm happy, which was an unusual occurrence. And then I went, oh, I'm drunk. And it was literally, I've said to Mandy, it was like a neural pathway the size of the M1 was formed in that moment, looking at this really horrible wallpaper on the loo. Who says it's not glamorous, right? So anyway, it kind of carried on. The only way I can kind of describe it really is that it was like there were two Kates as well. There was like, I was really into fitness, I was really into yoga, I was really into nutrition, I was quite a good girl, you know, like as a teen I was in the church choir and I was a straight A student, so there was this part of me that just was sort of squeaky clean. And then there was this other part that was just, it was like Jekyll and Hyde. Then, you know, binge drinking, smoking. I mean, I remember at my wedding, in one somebody's speech, they said that I could smoke enough to kill an elephant. And it was like, so there was just this kind of dichotomy going on, which I sort of veered between the two, and knowing really that there was something not right, knowing that I was getting very busy, I was distracting myself and I was coping a lot, but I wasn't really happy a lot of the time. So fast forward to motherhood, and all I can say is the kind of chasm became wider, the disconnect became wider, as suddenly I couldn't get to a hot yoga class. I couldn't kind of manage this kind of unwieldy sort of balancing act that I was doing before, and it became less and less balanced. And I think, you know, my husband was working late in London. I had moved to the burbs to get a house after my second child, so we weren't living in this in a flat in Party Town, Brighton anymore. We were grown-ups living in the burbs, but I literally had no one that I knew and connected with, despite going to mum and baby groups. I felt like I'd landed on a different planet, really. So I was lonely, and in retrospect, my mental health was suffering even more. You know, I think I had some depression, and I still had my anxiety. And it was like the party was sort of over, but inside I didn't know who I was. I think I had that real identity crisis that so many mums feel when they become mums. It's kind of, I always say, it's a bit of an unholy shock, your first child, because you're just like, what on earth has just happened to me in my entire life? And suddenly I was there, you know, party of one on the patio, me and a bottle of wine, you know, and I'm just going, this sucks. This is just not fun, but I don't know what else to do because I can't get out. I have no childcare. I can't get to a hot yoga class. I can't give the baby to anyone. So who am I and what am I doing? And at that point, yeah, I just think it took a sinister turn. And I'm quite interested in how we measure what is an alcohol problem, because on the surface, I worked so hard being quite a good girl to only drink just a bit over the recommended units. But all of my energy was going into it. I was working so hard at moderating for years and years and years, setting rules, failing, setting, right, I'll only drink on a Saturday, but then I'd go get to Friday and go, I can't help myself. And then I would beat myself up. So I was caught in this very nasty cycle of self-flagellation about my behaviour, feeling quite ashamed of myself a lot, you know. Again, like Mandy, I Googled, am I an alcoholic, more times than I've had hot dinners. And then one night in 2000, I can't remember if it was 2012 or 13, I found Soberistas. And again, blogged for the first time, met a community of like-minded women. You know, I was like, okay, I don't really identify with the stereotypes of an alcoholic. I'm a nice middle-class girl. Like, I can't, you know, just, I couldn't cope with that. I've never lost my driving license. I've got loads going for me. You know, I don't really understand it. And then I woke up the next morning. I sent up this flare at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And when I woke up to about 8 or 9 messages on my blog saying, we get you. We're there. We're the same as you. It's all right. Just do this. Read this book. Take one day at a time. And check in with us, you know, later on. And it was like I exhaled. It was like, okay, I've got a place to be, really. So that's where I'm. And like Mand, I did a year. I tried to stop so many times, but I stopped for a year, 13 months. And then went back, thought, oh, I've done loads of self-development, I'll be fine. And of course we know how that ends. And you're just like, oh no, I thought I'd be the one person to get away with it. I honestly did. I thought, I know it doesn't work for anyone else, but I would be that one person who could do it. And of course I didn't. And then went backwards and forwards, putting together the rest of it, you know, the self-care stuff and the stress management and all the tools. And I'm now 4.5 years continuous sobriety. So that's where I'm at.
Congratulations. Thank you. I love your confession of thinking that you could be the one person who does this differently.
I know. I was nodding to myself like, yeah, that was me as well. I thought I was that person.
And I'm picturing around the world, there are thousands of listeners right now nodding with their headphones on. Yep, me too. We all, we all confess to thinking that. You know, I hear some similarities between your stories, and not only that you both quit for a while and then went back to it and then quit again for good. But there's that sort of what Brené Brown calls bento box thinking, or compartmentalizing ourselves. Mm. Kate, you talk about the duplicity of, you know, being a young woman who has different parts to herself, or even as a mom feeling like, you know, I can keep these boxes separate. And Mandy, for you, the denial of your trauma and trying to pack it away and cope in spite of it rather than dealing with it. And for me, I certainly had imposter syndrome. Do you find that recovery brings you authenticity? Is that a big part of your healing? Mandy, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel quite emotional. It's true. I feel quite emotional. I think, I don't know if we said this right at the beginning, but I think it's because we're talking to you, Jean, and your podcast was the first sober podcast I listened to. So, definitely. I mean, I was so lost. I just didn't know who I was anymore. And I'd just been trying to, you know, control everything. And I thought there was this real thing about normality. It was like, if I can control my mental health, if I can be normal, then I don't have, you know, I don't have depression. So if I can hold down a good job or have, you know, a marriage, then I don't have trauma. You know, it was just these kind of batting backs of things all the time. If like, you know, this obsession with normality. And so every time that I kind of got a little bit better, or I was managing things in a way, then it was like, okay, well, I have to drink because that's what normal people do. You know, it was this constant like tug of war of trying to, yeah, essentially not own what had happened to me and just be like, if I can cope with all these things, then I'll be a normal person. And so if a normal person hasn't had the trauma that I've had, so, you know, or doesn't have depression. And there was a real resentment too, you know, and I think we have this definitely with, you know, women in the community that we have or women that we've worked with as coaches, you know, and you go through those periods of resentment where it's like, why me? You know, this is so unfair. And part of that kind of clinging to what should be fair was drinking. You know, if I can drink, then it, like my whole world hasn't fallen apart. And that thing of keeping alcohol in the center of everything, you know, on this pedestal of importance now, looking back, is like, my goodness, like there's so many other important things, you know, and me being my authentic self, that's what's important. That's the center of it all. That's a pivotal point. And I can only do that when I'm not drinking alcohol. And I didn't like what I looked like. I hate looking in the mirror. I had no self-worth at all. And I didn't like myself. And I thought so many things were my fault. And now I do. I like myself, which is just a crazy concept for any woman to say, really. Like, I think I'm all right, you know. And living as an authentic parent is just such a special sort of experience, you know, having that kind of true honesty with my kids about my life, about what's happened to me. And, you know, living with no shame is just incredibly beautiful experience. Authenticity is that reconnection with you, isn't it? And Kate, you talk about that a lot, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, when you're talking there, man, because, you know, my trauma too, like we were talking to Dawn Nicol from She Recovers over the weekend, and we'd asked her the same sort of question. We were like, so why do you think women drink? And she said she felt like it was pretty much always trauma of some kind, whether it was big T trauma or small T trauma. And I had adverse childhood experiences. And I think I had some neurodiversity, which it leads, you know, when you're a highly sensitive person or you have sensory processing stuff, every, you know, normal daily life can be quite traumatic on a nervous system level. This is really recent learning for me because of my parenting experience at the moment. But I think what happens, and you talk about almost like having a fractured self, which and a disconnect, and I think that's what happens when people have, especially women, I can't speak for men, but it's part of the female experience, is that you carry a shame that isn't yours to carry. You end up carrying the shame of what happened. And it's like a bag that doesn't actually belong to you because somebody else did it, right? But for some reason, because of that, you have this kind of, I see it so often, this disconnect from self, this self-aversion. And part of my absolute seminal moment for me was after the last time I drank, and I was so broken the next day. It was at my sister-in-law's 40th birthday, and I felt so anxious. It was like, shh, I'm here again. I'm just here again. I cannot believe I'm here again. I felt like I'd been in the boxing ring with Mike Tyson, and I couldn't get on the tube. That's the underground in London, because I was having such bad panic attacks. And I finally managed to get home to my family, and we went to the beach. It was a beautiful day. My beautiful children and my loving husband and a beautiful beach. And I lay there feeling like a ghost and feeling like a shell and feeling like nothing was real and I was totally separated from my life. And then I went home and someone had recommended Tara Brach, you know, the Rain of Self-Compassion. And she's a Buddhist psychologist and takes you through this kind of self-compassion practice. And I'd put it off and put it off, and I plugged my ear. I just felt, you know, like that awful, awful creeping sensation you have, which almost like I can't remember now, but I plugged it in and I listened and I went through the process. And I've said this to Amanda, I felt like I literally got it. It was like this connection was made with myself. And I realized that if I drink, I disconnect, that chasm opens up even more, and I can't find myself for about a week to even comfort. I can't find myself. And that causes such a profound shame response that I literally felt broken. And I went, that's it, I'm done. I don't care about the labels. I don't care about the ifs and buts. I don't care about what group you're in. I don't care about anything. My busy, busy mind. I went, that's it, I don't care about that anymore. This is my experience. This is what happens to me. And I felt like I found my little precious self by doing that reign of self-compassion. And I was like, I'm not leaving her again. I can't leave her again because it's too damn painful. And that was the last time I drank. So you saying that authenticity, that like feeling of landing in your own skin, of that true north of being, living my life, it's like, hell yeah. Hell to the yeah, and that's where I'm staying, you know.
Yeah, that is amazing. So your podcast is Love Sober, and I want to make sure we leave time to talk about the book, but quickly let's just go over how the two of you got together and started a podcast. Kate, tell me about that.
Okay, so I came out from the, you know, it's really funny, we've ended up really deep diving, haven't we, already? And I feel like, you know, there's that side to everyone's story, I must say, that is all sort of really extraordinary and ordinary all at the same time, because we're like two mums.
Yeah,
Mandy's in France, I'm in England. I have a smelly dog, she's got a beautiful cat, we've both got kids, and we were both just doing the school runs and trying to work out our lives, so like to bring it sort of back down to earth a little bit. And so anyway, I decided that I kind of knew, I was doing a lot of reading around the science of happiness, I really wanted to own it and talk about it and be real with being sober. I didn't want to hide behind things, and it's things like, I like, you know, if you're jealous of people, then you know that that's a little signal to you that you need to kind of get off your butt and do something about it, right? And I think someone had a book out and I was really jealous. I was like, well, I want to write a book. And it's like, oh, you have to kind of like be visible and walk it a little bit out in the real world before you can kind of do that, right? So anyway, I was working with a coach, fantastic coach called Sarah, who I'd met on the sober community, and I put out my blog, Love Sober, and a press to publish, and I was sweating, and I was like, no, I've got to do it. Mandy and I met each other on Soberistas, but she stalked me, didn't you? Because she liked the blog.
Yeah, well, I mean, what had happened for me was, because I'd been back and forth so many times, you know, it was like, and when I first joined Soberistas, it was really quite small. There was about, I don't know, probably about 1,000 people or something. And now there's like 60,000 people. And so every time I went back, it was like I couldn't really see the same people anymore. And I was in that weird space where I wasn't a newbie, but I was on day one again. So it was this really weird thing. And I remember Kate's little icon. So I was like, ooh. And then I started reading her blogs and I was like, I liked her writing. And then I saw her website, and it, you know, appealed to me, as Kate wanted to do. It was like, be aesthetically appealing and attractive and make sobriety feel exciting. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want. And so we got chatting and we kind of actually realized that we would have lived when we didn't know each other before sobriety, but we would have lived in like the streets next to each other in Brighton at the same time. So we were probably drinking in the same pub, which is quite ironic.
We lived on the next road to each other. Yeah. How mad is that? And we never met.
And so I just went on my kind of coming back to sobriety. I'd set up my Instagram and I was getting really into podcasts, and I was like, this is such a brilliant way to reach people and talk about this, because you know, it can be anonymous, people don't have to tell people what they're listening to, you know, just listening to other people's conversations and the stories. I found it really, really engaging. But I couldn't find one for people like me, you know, like British binge drinking now mums. Yeah, that kind of cultural experience. And so I asked Kate one day, we'd never met, and I was like, do you want to do a podcast? And she was like, yeah, okay.
How do we do it?
You know, in our kitchens, kind of like, well, I don't know, researching. And then I got a friend of mine involved, and he did the music for a little bit. And then Kate's husband got involved, and he sort of carried on doing the tech for a little bit. And then, you know, now we do it ourselves. But yeah. I mean, we'd done the podcast. We started recording it before we'd ever met in real life.
What was it like when you did finally meet in real life? Was it just like instant pajama party sister? There's no small talk in recovery. I mean, we've proved that here. Yeah. We go straight to the good stuff.
Yeah, no, it was really funny. I mean, I came down on the train from London, and just we went straight to Kate's house, and we're just having a cup of tea, and then we just kind of burst out laughing. Like, this is funny but normal, but you know, so
yeah, because yeah. We've done a lot of talking by that point, hadn't we?
Yeah,
you've do such a lot of talking. And so yeah, it did. It just and it's kind of one of those things. I think we didn't want to even. There was no nothing in our heads. Like, supposing we don't get on in real life, it, like, that was not going to be a possibility.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it was all really organic, you know. And then it was then Kate was like, sort of about 6 months later, was like, you know, well, I was working on a book proposal. You know, would you like to sort of collaborate? And we were both doing coaching, and, you know, Kate was doing sort of personal performance coaching and life coaching, and I was doing recovery coaching. And then we were like, right, if we put all our skills in a basket, you know, we can really come up with what we think women need and what we needed, actually, and create the change that we were looking for, and speak to mums and speak to people that were having our experience, really. And so it's been this really beautiful, organic kind of creative journey. It's all a journey.
We need a new word other than journey. But it really is it's overused for a reason. Yep. Because it really does capture the experience. It never turns out the way we think it will. It's usually harder, messier, but somehow better than we think. The whole thing. Well, let's talk about the book, Love Yourself Sober. You dedicate it to caregivers. I'm assuming because motherhood so profoundly impacted your experience, not just in recovery, but also, you know, your experience with alcohol. But let's start out by just talking about that. Why do you think that women are, in 2020, experiencing the incredible pressures not just with life, but with alcohol? What's going on there? And why are women so profoundly impacted right now? I know it's a big question, so don't feel that you have to give a complete synopsis.
There's a couple of things.
What was on your heart?
I mean, I think that it started off because of our experiences, you know. And again, another mother sort of metaphor saying whatever is, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. And so it came from our need to understand our experience, to have a really 360 look at the impact of life, of marketing, of the social messaging around being mum, being a woman, you know, and also the piece that alcohol plays in it as well, to look at the kind of spectrum as well, of to say, okay, well, there's this alcohol use disorder spectrum. And I think for both of us, I mean, for Amandi, there was this, the more profound, I suppose, mental health piece at some point. And for me, there was that sort of, I had gone to healthcare professionals for years asking for permission to stop, and I was given permission to continue. They would say, count your units, look at this wheel, you know. And so there was this, it was quite a lot of moving parts and quite a lot of pieces to unpick. And I think that that is where the sort of the need to write it all down sort of came from, and then the need to kind of try and solve it, you know, because we need to do that. And I think for mums, I mean, we think that what happened really, there's a few things, but what happened on social media, for example, was there was this kind of there was a backlash against this need to be perfect, looking like a supermodel. I would say having a Bowden, Kath Kidston, they're two kind of British brands, I think, having a bun fight whilst looking really hot, you know. And and it was just that kind of have a seat at the table as well, like get a university education, go and boss a career. And there was suddenly, you know, have it all. And it was like, but actually, you know, we all start to get frazzled and burnt out because there wasn't the right support for parents and carers, really. And then suddenly on social media, there was a kind of honest parenting movement about, okay, we're not going to look like these perfect role models. There were people, you know, feeding their kids, breastfeeding, sitting on the toilet, surrounded by washing, saying this is hard. But it sort of got coupled with alcohol. And it kind of, you know, and I'm going to, and we had hurrah for gin, we had loads of, you know, mummy juice kind of things. So this kind of perfect storm happened where women were expecting to do it all, be it all, you know, do the lion's share of the home, the child rearing, have a career, have a job. And we're also getting targeted very heavily then by the marketeers who have taken this trend and are literally aggressively pinkwashing drinks. And it's become so normalised, the problem drinking for mums, and so confusing that we really wanted to sort of talk about that. And then it's the kind of, okay, what do we do about it? What are we actually needing? And maybe Man could sort of take over and talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, both Kate and I had burnout at different points. You know, I can remember at one point saying to my dad, you know, but, you know, because I grew up as a feminist, as a lot of our generation did, you know, we were like emancipated, you know, it was a growth from where our mums were, where their mums were. So we were like, right, okay, we're suddenly at the table and we can have a career and we can, you know, be mums. And then there wasn't the support underneath. So, and I can remember saying to my dad, but I just can't, you know, I've got to. And he was like, but Mandy, someone's got to be there to pick up the children after school. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's true. And he was like, that can be you, you know. And I was like, oh, wow. Because I was so fixated that I had to be a career woman and I had to be the perfect mum at the same time. But, you know, someone had to look after the kids, you know, that caring role was there. And so, you know, we're in a position now, I think, as a generation of like that, you know, work-life balance is a conversation that everyone's having all the time, and stress and, you know, burnout. And, you know, mums are very much still in a position of doing a lot of unpaid labor, you know, and the recognition of the role of a mum is still hugely undervalued in society. So, you know, what was happening was like, right, well, how do we cope with this? And then you're being sold a solution, which is just like, well, you know, have a glass of wine, mummy wine time. And, you know, and because we were all so isolated as well, you know, I was in France and I used to sit on with my friends on social media and we'd have like a cheers with our glasses of wine across Instagram, you know, like, oh, we're still together. There was a sense of kind of bonding about it. But we're asking the wrong questions and we're kind of accepting the wrong solution, really, because what we should be sort of saying is, hang on a second, we need to actually have a break and we need boundaries and we need to be able to say, I need to rest, and we need to be able to put ourselves in the position of the family and have a respected space within the family and say, you know, no, it's okay to rest. We talk about rest all the time. It's okay not to, you know, be doing, you know, the best Halloween costumes and at the same time, you know, organizing a charity event. And at the same time, you know, we don't have to be perfect and we can just delegate and we can say no and we can reclaim some of that. And so when we talk about self-care, I mean, obviously there's the part of self-care which is nurturing you, which is really important for sobriety, to say, you know, you're worth it, I love you, let's have a nice bath or moisturize, you know, make friends with yourself again. But part of self-care is that, you know, self-leadership and being able to say, actually, this is what I need to make my life work and manageable. And so I'm going to put myself in a position with a clear mind and not numb myself out with alcohol, to really kind of ask better questions and get the support I really need. And I think alcohol rids us of that chance to be able to, you know, really look after ourselves and look after our kids. And I think that's the thing, because certainly what I realized was I was in a position of controlling alcohol so much, trying to make it work and keep it in my life, that everything was so stressful and I was so trying to control things all the time, and I'd lost fun. I was just not a fun mum. And then when I stopped drinking, you know, it's the opposite of what you think. He's like, oh, sobriety is really boring and I'm going to be all alone. And it's completely the opposite, because I'm so stupid now with my kids. And I just don't care as much about that kind of stress perfectionism. It's just like, okay, well, let's just, you know, eat. My kids are eating, you know, PJ and jelly sandwiches tonight, you know, for dinner, that's okay, and a glass of milk. I mean, they love it, but it's fine, you know, it won't it's and so I think what we really tried to do with the book is just to, first of all, give mums a big cuddle and say, we get you, we've been there, we shared the same experience, and then sort of gently sort of say, let's get you to a place where you can, you know, look after yourself in a way that's going to be sustainable and healthy and make you feel good, you know, and look for the good stuff in life, which alcohol kind of takes away, I suppose.
Mm. You know, I'm onto a different stage of life. My kids are grown. I'm a grandmother now. I still can't believe it. I like saying it, but I'm not sure how it happened. But I actually felt quite emotional as I read your book, thinking about how much I needed that book when I was a young mom, and wondering how things might have turned out differently for me had I had your book then. I actually said yes out loud when I got to the part where you call out the idea of alcohol as being self-care.
Yeah.
We're really fed that idea, and moms are always looking for quick fixes and convenience. And so once we start turning to alcohol as self-care and using it, we start to become reliant on it. And then the trajectory of addiction makes us slowly forget all the other pleasures that are available to you. As you said, like a bath, like a lovely, you know, massaging our feet with lotion or having a little bit of dark chocolate. And then the cycle of HALT, which is an acronym we often hear used to remind us of main triggers, which are hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. Well, that is also motherhood. I mean, I spent 15 years being hungry, angry, lonely, and tired.
Yeah.
So you're in a constant state of triggering, and then you are slowly trained to have only one go-to for self-care. And then and it never works, but you keep going back to it. And so I was so pleased at the way that you called out that nonsense and offered solutions for it. So bravo to you for that. And
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that whole thing about, I think what happened, you know, after that first year of sobriety for me, and I think for Mand as well, for me, it was definitely that journey of self-care. That was it. That was the toolkit that I needed for life to make me happy. And that we drew on, you know, the science of happiness. You know, it's like those old wisdoms with the shiny new neuroscience. But, you know, things like awe, things like wonder, things like hobbies and things that light us up, things that soothe our nervous system, things that, you know, the science of gratitude, you know, that the connection, the connectivity between people, like having your sober community, like all of these things that are the real self-care. They're, like you said, this idea of alcohol that we've been sold as this self-care, this false faux self-care. But what is the real stuff is all of that. And that's really sort of, there's been a bit of a revolution in that, I think, a bit of an explosion of all of that stuff, which now it's almost like because of neuroscience, there's the proof of it, you know. So it's got a kind of, it's gained traction recently, you know, that whole, the wellness kind of aspect of sobriety and sober living, I think, which was so needed for mums. Like you say, you're constantly in these state of triggers. You're under an enormous amount of pressure. So you need radical self-care of the most badass kind, don't you?
Yeah, and I think it is. It's that kind of, you know, it's calling out, yeah, the reality of the female experience, really, because, you know, if we're talking about, you know, trauma being one of the main elements of, you know, addictive behavior or dependence, then the amount of women that have had Me Too experiences, you know, you're talking to the amount of women that have undiagnosed postnatal depression, that's a vulnerable group, you know, that are being heavily, heavily marketed for alcohol. And so when you start to sort of see it through that lens of kind of what women really are experiencing in life, it's like, hang on a second, that this isn't right. And what we love, I mean, you know, She Recovers is amazing community, you know, women supporting women, you know, we have a women only community, and there's huge, huge conversations to have about men's mental health. Absolutely. But the fact that we can look after each other and that we can support each other is such a kind of, it's a gift. And, you know, when women enter communities and they just have that, as Kate said, that relief of just like, okay, I'm not alone. And, you know, and that's such a wonderful thing. And that's really not the messages we're being sold. You know, it's like, you can't connect without me is one of the biggest kind of selling points about alcohol marketing. It's like, you will be alone if you don't drink. And that's just not the case. And so again, it's that sort of looking at, how do we socialize? There's so many ways you can socialize. You don't just have to socialize in a bar. You know, you can get that from doing yoga with people, or you can get that for going for a walk, and you're actually going to have fantastic conversations that you remember. You know, so I think it's just trying to, the book really is just to try and sort of ask those questions about things, that the narratives that we're told, and sort of turning them on their head and going, really, is this actually good enough for us? And no, you know, it's not, you know, we deserve more.
Do you have a population of men that listen to your podcast and have read your book? What kind of feedback are you getting from the other side of this relationship?
We have some gay men who like us.
Yeah, we do have a few. We do have a few dads.
And we have male friends within the sober community. We've got some very, very good male friends, but it, you know, even though, like, we've got a lovely friend called Simon Chappell who has, and he's a lovely dad, and he's got a community in a book and stuff, and but most of the people in his community are women, so the sort of it still does seem to be largely on the, you know, on the forums, it still seems to be a lot of female activity rather than the men in the UK. We see that definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think perhaps, well, I can hypothesize that, you know, AA was very strongly male and a very strongly male narrative. So I think, you know, communities that have come more recently have kind of been tried to answer a need that AA wasn't perhaps giving for some people. So, but I do think there's now becoming another nuanced things that we're starting to see that, you know, there's an important to talk about race, there's importance to, you know, talk about diversity within groups, and certainly to talk about men's mental health and supporting them kind of earlier on, because it seems like there's still quite a rock bottom narrative with men, which women seem like, thankfully, we seem to be moving away from that a little bit and being able to sort of ask questions a bit earlier on in the sort of relationship with alcohol, and men seem to still, because of that you know, disconnect with being able to talk about their feelings or having to man up, you know, and that toxic masculinity are unfortunately still being left, you know, on the side a little bit. But it is changing. And I've seen, you know, a few men coming through sort of as coaches.
And we've got a lovely, another really good friend called Michael Maisie. And he has the most amazing story. And he does great work with young men, you know, from difficult backgrounds. He was in prison himself. And he has, you know, turned it around. So, like, he's a proper legend. So there are some men doing some great work, you know, and with some of the younger guys as well. So fingers crossed that will, you know, that will grow, like Mandy said.
I love that we're at least having the conversation. And one thing I have learned, Esther Perel, I don't know if you're familiar with her work. She primarily deals with relationships and couples therapy. She's really fascinating, but she reminds us that we don't have to turn to our partners to fill all of our needs, that we can look to elsewhere in our relationships to fill some of those needs. And particularly for me, that reminded me that it's not my husband's job to listen to my every thought.
Yeah.
I'm much more of a talker than he is. So he will tell you he's pretty happy that I figured this out. And so that, I think, is why it feels so good. And for women, a lot of us sort things out by talking about them.
Yeah.
And when we get together, we just fall naturally into that process, whereas I think men have a less of an inclination to work through their feelings that way. They're much more action driven by nature, and speaking in general terms. I think that's why programs that have steps and actions to take really appeal to men, whereas for women, gathering together and talking about our commonalities and looking into each other's eyes and being in each other's presence fills us up in a different way. And I'm reminded that for women, it's even how we're built. I mean, our menstrual cycles will align with the women that we are in contact with. I mean, our bodies are built this way to connect and align with the women around us. And so I feel like it's a reflection of how we're built in the way that we like to communicate and talk about things.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah.
And it's so important to remember that part of the you know, the female experience and that sort of, the circles and the connection and the... the embodied, you know, we go on about the patriarchy, don't we, man? We like to have a bit of a go at the patriarchy, but there's that, you know, who doesn't, right?
But it's needed, yeah. They're not going anywhere yet.
We do need those spaces. We have needed those spaces, and we do need women only spaces, just like men might, you know, they, you know, and like the nuances and the diversity and the intersections need safe spaces.
And so, I do think, you know, there's part of something that I've been noticing recently where, because of, you know, motherhood is, as it, you know, it's a hard journey, because essentially you love someone more than you love anything else, and then you have to prepare for them to become independent and then not need you anymore. it's quite challenging as a concept, you know. And so I think there is something that I've been seeing in our community recently where you know, I sort of, why do people stick around? You know, why do they stay and they want to help other people? And it does kind of fill that kind of nurturing need for people. It's like, I'm still here. I can support others. And I think it does help with the female experience to have those close relationships with other women, because it allows you to kind of, I suppose, fill the gap a little bit. And, you know, we were filling that gap or that pain with booze, and now it's like, well, we get to fill that with sort of nurturing relationships with other women. And I think it's been something interesting to watch, and it's a great part of that. It's like, okay, this is actually something that, and probably our kids is all sighing, you know, in relief, like, thank goodness they've got something else to think about, not just us, you know. So it's a great thing in that sense. And I do think men need it as well, you know. We need mixed spaces, and we need separate spaces. We need both.
Yeah, we need it all. Yeah,
I also love that my recovery allows me to be completely reliably on standby for my children who are grown now. So if they do need me, they know they can call me anytime and they don't have to worry of whether or not, you know, oh, it's past 9 o'clock, mom, let's not call her now. She's not at her best in the evenings. Mm-hmm. No, they know that I'm always present and available. And I feel really great about that.
Yeah.
No, and I feel a little less needy about it, I guess, because just knowing that, you know, I'm here if you need me and you can count on me is a really lovely, lovely way to be as I get older and know that I'm not a burden in their lives. Mm. And the way I was headed on my drinking trajectory, I would have really been a problem for them right now. So it's very freeing in that way too. I love it. Okay. Tell our listeners, how can they find you? How can they find your podcast and get your book?
So we are, but basically the easiest way to find us is at lovesober.com. Everything lives there and everything signposts to sort of everything else. So there's a drop down to the podcast. There's links for the book. You can join our community space from there. So really head over there for everything. Mandy, the Instagram, which I'm no good at.
So I mean, the podcast is on all, like, you know, channels that you can get it. The only thing I'd say with the book at the moment, it's not available on amazon.com until March next year. So if you're in the US, then the best place to get it is from the Book Depository, because you get free shipping. Or you can download it on a Kindle or get the audiobook, which will be released soon. Instagram, we are at lovesober.cic. CIC stands for Community Interest Company. So we, part of our kind of bigger picture next year is looking for government funding or from investment so that we can, do courses for people on lower incomes, because, you know, a lot of the demographic we work with are mums, you know, single mums or mums that are stay-at-home mums and they don't have a lot of money. So that's a real kind of problem area that needs supporting. And other than that, I am at Mandy Manners Coach, and Kate is at Kate Bailey Coach on Instagram, and we're on Facebook as well.
And the last thing I'd say about the book is that we actually dedicated it to carers, because we really felt that, you know, we don't all look like nuclear families, right? We might have two dads, we might be caring for an older parent, an ailing parent, and still be experiencing being under the cosh and being incredibly depleted. So it's really trying to care for carers, whatever your family might look like, whatever that situation might look like.
I love it. Mandy Manners and Kate Bailey, thank you so much for joining me on the Bubble Hour.
Oh, thanks for having us.
It's been amazing to talk to you. Like, yeah. Just, I feel really overwhelmed. I really do. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Absolutely. And listeners, I hope you've enjoyed this hour. Please be sure to touch base with Mandy and Kate. I will have all of the links to the resources and connections mentioned in the show notes. So check there for those links. That's all for this week, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take good care.
I did that, not proud, but that was me. And when I face it, I take back a little dignity, not looking for excuses. I just want to be free from the power weakness had on me. In a dark corner is where shame likes to hide. Oh, you think you're strong just cause you keep it on the side. It just stays and wait there to rob you of your pride. Turn the light on, turn the light on, you can shine. When you see the old, I did that, not proud, but that was me. And when I face it, I take back a little dignity. I'm not looking for excuses, I just want to be free from power. Thank you. is looking at you in the mirror, and the one who matters most can always hear when you say, I owned it, not proud, but that was me. And when I face it, I take back a little dignity. I'm not looking for excuses, I just want to be free from the power weakness had on me. When you say, I owned it, I did that, not proud, but that was me. And when I face it, I take back a little dignity. I'm not looking for excuses, I just want to.